BBC, BBC.
Now in the BBC World Service, witness. It's over 50 years since a white journalist disguised himself as an African-American to experience firsthand the realities of racism in the Deep South. Chloe Hadjimatheo reports on the story of John Howard Griffin. Listeners should be aware that some of the language in this programme reflects the historical context of the time.
It's November 1959, and in the southern states of the USA, segregation between whites and blacks is part of the very fabric of society. African Americans are second-class citizens without access to the schools, hospitals, housing, and other facilities used by whites. Lynching's not uncommon. It's in this tense atmosphere that a white journalist, John Howard Griffin, decides to change the colour of his skin and live as a black man.
I said I declare, I ain't gonna be bad no more.
One of the influences behind his radical decision was his loss of sight. After being injured as a soldier in the Second World War, he remained blind for almost a decade.
His blindness is certainly one of the influences upon his decision. In the most obvious way, if you're blind, then you're not perceiving the color of one's skin. When he was blind, he couldn't tell whether he was listening to black or white people. They all had the same accents, except, of course, what they talked about and how they expressed themselves.
Roberto Benazzi became a close friend in the 1960s. He says that after regaining his sight, Griffin got a job with Sepia, a magazine which had a predominantly black readership. When he was trying to write articles for the publication, he often asked African Americans about their experiences living under segregation, but he always got the same response.
If you want to know what it's like to be black, you have to be black and you can't otherwise know. So bingo, he thought, how do I disguise myself? How do I go through the South as a black man and experience what black people experience? So he brought this idea to the Sepia magazine people. At the time, the editor was Adele Jackson, a black woman, and she counseled him not to do it.
But Griffin was determined to go ahead with his experiment. He approached a dermatologist in New Orleans who told him it was possible to alter the colour of his skin by taking very high doses of a pigment-altering medicine.
He took this drug called oxorolin, which is used to change the colour of your skin. And where it didn't quite take, he would use a little dye, especially around his mouth and eyes.
So what Griffin did was really irreversible, at least for a few days or weeks. If he had been in any danger, he would have had quite a hard time persuading people he was white.
That's true. He thought he was going to have a hard time persuading people he was black. He had thin lips and he had a straight nose and he spoke with a very educated accent, and he thought all those things would give him away, but they were not real problems. White people, even though they saw black people, all they saw was the color. They just assumed that they all looked alike. As soon as he got into the black areas, he looked around and he found people with every kind of eye color, long hair, straight hair, curly hair, because some of their ancestors are white. And so you have every kind of physiognomy that you could imagine.
Speaking in an interview with the BBC in 1964, Griffin explained that he consulted the police before he went ahead with his plan.
I discussed with the FBI, because I was already well known in the South as a writer, whether I should change my name. And we talked at great length about this, and we said, no, keep the name. If anybody asks a question, just tell the truth. And the weird part, of course, was that in 7 weeks of contacts daily with whites, no one ever even asked my name. It was boy, it was uncle, it was something like this.
Griffin spent 3 weeks holed up in a small room in New Orleans waiting for the drug to take effect. Once the transformation was complete, he stepped out onto the streets one November evening as a black man.
That night I asked 3 different people the best place to find a room. And I went to this one and I asked for the best room, and they put me in a small room, about a little bit larger than the size of a bed. And when this man went away and closed the door, I sat down on that bed and I realized that I was an elderly-looking Negro man. Then it was when it really struck me that here I was in a city that I knew very well. Always before, I'd been received in the best homes and the best hotels and the finest restaurants. Everything about me felt the same. I had the same name, I had the same background, the same needs, the same clothing, even the same wallet and the same kind of money. And yet I knew that for one reason alone, because of my pigmentation, there was not enough money in the world to buy me accommodations in a first-class hotel that night.
Over the next few weeks, Griffin set out to find a job. He trawled the papers and called employers who had placed wanted ads.
I would say exactly the truth. I would say, this is John Griffin. I'm a graduate of the University of Poitiers. I've just arrived in New Orleans and I'm looking for work. And in every case, it excited enough interest for me to be quite certain that I had that job. And then they would ask me to come in for an interview. And when I would go in and they would see that this was a Negro, they would always find some marvelously plausible reason why that job was no longer available. I did this again and again and again. And the best jobs that I ever got were shoeshine boy, unloading trucks, and portering briefly in a bus station. In one place, in Mobile, I applied for a very humble sort of job as a typist. And this personnel manager said, "Why, no, there's no possibility of that." And I asked him if I could do the job better and would take less money. And he said, "No, it's not a question of that." He said, "Some of you people got in here during the war and got fairly good jobs. But," he said, "we're gradually getting you weeded out. And pretty soon the only jobs you can have are something that no white man would hold." And he said it in about that tone of voice, you know, not hostile tone, but telling me the facts of life. And I said, "Well, how can we live?" He said, "That's the whole point. We just don't want you."
But Griffin's friend, Roberto Bonazzi, says that his most shocking experiences of racism came while he was hitchhiking through Mississippi and Alabama.
Most of the rides were from white men, and all of them began quizzing him about his sex life and the sex life of black people, the presumption being that it was a much more open, quote-unquote, animalistic kind of experience. And, of course, he did his best to avoid this, what he called verbal pornography, and tried to argue with some of these men. And as soon as he did, they let him out of the truck.
One of these men who wanted a date with my wife and was trying to force it. And when I wouldn't do it, he said, "You know what we do with smart aleck niggas here?" This was in Alabama. And I said, "No." He said, "Well, they kill you, throw you in the pen," which means the same thing. Then he gave me this hate stare. And, you know, the terrifying thing was that you could see nothing behind there to which you could appeal for mercy or for compassion. And the terror that I felt constantly wasn't the terror of what they were going to do to me, but it was the terror of what they were doing to themselves. It was this awful dehumanization of themselves. And as Negroes, because we know what this situation does for the whites, and that they are just as entrapped by the system. So the thing that I discovered really in all of this horrible thing is that the oppressor is ultimately as much a victim of racism as the oppressed.
After 7 weeks of living as a black man, Griffin wrote a book about his experiences. But before it was even published, word of his experiment had got out and his effigy was being burnt in his hometown in Texas.
I knew I was going to catch it, but I didn't know that they would aim their worst at my parents, who were elderly, gentle people. And it broke them so horribly that they sold their home and moved away. It breaks all of us, everybody who has spoken up and who has seen the savage, beastly lengths to which they will go to suppress you. I went into it as an objective scientist, and I came out of it a broken human being.
Griffin, his wife, children, and parents were forced to flee to Mexico. It would be more than a year before he could return to the United States. Segregation was formally abolished in 1964. Griffin's book, Black Like Me, is still taught in schools and universities across the United States.
Chloe Hadjimatheo. And if you'd like to join the programme on Facebook, just search for BBC Witness.